watching her. His coffin lay there, heaped with scars and pieces of tapestry. I had the compulsion to open it. I had the wish to see him there. "Nothing," she finally said in disgust. She wadded the clothes into the grate. "Not a hint of where he came from, who made him," she said. "Not a scrap." She looked to me as if for sympathy. I turned away from her. I was unable to look at her. I moved back into that bedroom which I kept for myself, that room filled with my own books and what things I'd saved from my mother and sister, and I sat on the bed. I could hear her at the door, but I would not look at her. "He deserved to die," she said to me. "Then we deserve to die. The same way. Every night of our lives," I said back to her. "Go away from me." It was as if my words were my thoughts, my mind alone, only formless confusion. "I'll care for you because you can't care for yourself, but I don't want you near me. Sleep in that box you bought for yourself. Don't come near me."
"I told you I was going to do it."
"I told you," she said. Never had her voice sounded so fragile, so like a little silvery bell. I looked up at her, startled but unshaken. Her face seemed not her face. Never had anyone shaped such agitation into the features of a doll.
"Louis, I told you," she said, her lips quivering. "I did it for us, so we could be free."
I couldn't stand the sight of her. Her beauty, her seeming innocence, and this terrible agitation. I went past her, perhaps knocking her backwards, I don't know. And I was almost to the railing of the steps when I heard a strange sound. Never, in all the years of our life together, had I heard this sound. Never since the night long ago when I had first found her, a mortal child clinging to her mother. She was crying. It drew me back, now, against my will. Yet it sounded so unconscious, so hopeless, as though she meant no one to hear it, or didn't care if it were heard by the whole world. I found her lying on my bed in the place where I often sat to read, her knees drawn up, her whole frame shaking with her sobs. The sound of it was terrible. It was more heartfelt, more awful than her mortal crying had ever been. I sat down slowly, gently beside her and put my hand on her shoulder. She lifted her head, startled, her eyes wide, her mouth trembling. Her face was stained with tears, tears that were tinted with blood. Her eyes brimmed with them, and the faint touch of red stained her tiny hand. She didn't seem to be conscious of this, to see it. She pushed her hair back from her forehead. Her body quivered then with a long, low, pleading sob.
"Louis, if I lose you, I have nothing," she whispered. "I would undo it to have you back. I can't undo what I've done."
She put her arms around me, climbing up against me, sobbing against my heart. My hands were reluctant to touch her, and then they moved, as if I couldn't stop them, to enfold her, and hold her, and stroke her hair.
"I can't live without you," she whispered. "I would die rather than live without you. I would die the same way he died. I can't bear you to look at me the way you did. I cannot bear it if you do not love me."
Her sobs grew worse, more bitter, until finally I bent and kissed her soft neck and cheeks. Winter plums. Plums from an enchanted wood where the fruit never falls from the boughs, where the flowers never wither and die. "All right, my dear," I said to her. "All right, my love." And I rocked her slowly, gently in my arms until she dozed, murmuring something about our being eternally happy, free of Lestat forever, beginning the great adventure of our lives. The Great Adventure of Our Lives. What does it mean to die when you can live until the end of the world? And what is the end of the world except a phrase? because who knows even what is the world itself? I had now lived in 2 centuries, seen the illusions of one utterly shattered by the other, been eternally young and eternally ancient, possessing no illusions, living moment to moment in a way that made me picture a silver clock ticking in a void. The painted face, the delicately carved hands, looked upon by no one, looking out at no one, illuminated by a light which was not a light, like the light by which God made the world before he had made light. Ticking, ticking, ticking. The precision of the clock, in a room as vast as the universe. I was walking the streets again. Claudia gone her way to kill, the perfume of her hair and dress lingering on my fingertips, on my coat, my eyes moving far ahead of me like the pale beam of a lantern. I found myself at the cathedral. What does it mean to die when you can live until the end of the world? I was thinking of my brother's death, of the incense and the rosary. I had the desire suddenly to be in that funeral room, listening to the sound of the women's voices rising and falling with the aves, the clicking of the beads, the smell of the wax. I could remember the crying. It was palpable, as if it were just yesterday, just behind the door. I saw myself walking fast down a corridor, and gently giving the door a shove. The great facade of the cathedral rose in a dark mass opposite the square, but the doors were open and I could see a soft, flickering light within. It was Saturday evening early, and the people were going to confession for Sunday Mass and Communion. Candles burned dim in the chandeliers. At the far end of the nave the altar loomed out of the shadows, laden with white flowers. It was to the old church on this spot that they had brought my brother for the final service before the cemetery, and I realized suddenly that I hadn't been in this place since, never once come up the stone steps, crossed the porch, and passed through the open doors. I had no fear. If anything, perhaps, I longed for something to happen, for the stones to tremble as I entered the shadowy foyer and saw the distant tabernacle on the altar. I remembered now that I had passed here once, when the windows were ablaze, and the sound of singing poured out into Jackson Square. I had hesitated then, wondering if there were some secret Lestat had never told me, something which might destroy me were I to enter. I'd felt compelled to enter, but I had pushed this out of my mind, breaking loose from the fascination of the open doors, the throng of people making one voice. I had had something for Claudia, a doll I was taking to her, a bridal doll I'd lifted from a darkened toy shop window and placed in a great box with ribbons and tissue paper. A doll for Claudia. I remembered pressing on with it, hearing the heavy vibrations of the organ behind me, my eyes narrow from the great blaze of the candles. Now I thought of that moment, that fear in me at the very sight of the altar, the sound of the pange lingua, and I thought again, persistently, of my brother. I could see the coffin rolling along up the center aisle, the procession of mourners behind it. I felt no fear now. As I said, I think, if anything, I felt a longing for some fear, for some reason for fear, as I moved slowly along the dark stone walls. The air was chill and damp in spite of summer. The thought of Claudia's doll came back to me. Where was that doll? For years Claudia had played with that doll. Suddenly I saw myself searching for the doll, in the relentless and meaningless manner one searches for something in a nightmare. Coming on doors that won't open or drawers that won't shut, struggling over and over against the same meaningless thing, not knowing why the effort seems so desperate, why the sudden sight of a chair with a shawl thrown over it inspires the mind with horror. I was in the cathedral. A woman stepped out of the confessional and passed the long line of those who waited. A man who should have stepped up next did not move, and my eye, sensitive even in my vulnerable condition, noted this, and I turned to see him. He was staring at me. Quickly I turned my back on him. I heard him enter the confessional and shut the door. I walked up the aisle of the church, and then, more from exhaustion than from any conviction, went into an empty pew and sat down. I had almost genuflected from old habit. My mind seemed as muddled and tortured as that of any human. I closed my eyes for a moment and tried to banish all thoughts. "Hear and see," I said to myself. And with this act of will, my senses emerged from the torment. All around me in the gloom I heard the whisper of prayers, the tiny click of the rosary beads, soft the sighing of the women who knelt now at the 12th station. Rising from the sea of wooden pews came the scent of rats, a rat moving somewhere near the altar, a rat in the great wood-carved side altar of the Virgin Mary. The gold candlesticks shimmered on the altar, a rich white chrysanthemum bent suddenly on its stem, droplets glistening on the crowded petals, a sour fragrance rising from a score of vases, from altars and side altars, from statues of virgins and Christs and saints. I stared at the statues. I became obsessed suddenly and completely with the lifeless profiles, the staring eyes, the empty hands, the frozen folds. Then my body convulsed with such violence that I found myself pitched forward, my hand on the pew before me. It was a cemetery of dead forms, of funereal effigy and stone angels. I looked up and saw myself in a most palpable vision ascending the altar steps, opening the tiny sacrosanct tabernacle, reaching with monstrous hands for the consecrated ciborium, and taking the body of Christ, and strewing its white wafers all over the carpet, and walking then on the sacred wafers, walking up and down before the altar, giving holy communion to the dust. I rose up now in the pew and stood there staring at this vision. I knew full well the meaning of it. God did not live in this church. These statues gave an image to nothingness. I was the supernatural in this cathedral. I was the only supermortal thing that stood conscious under this roof. Loneliness. Loneliness to the point of madness. The cathedral crumbled in my vision. The saints listed and fell. Rats ate the Holy Eucharist and nested on the sills. A solitary rat with an enormous tail stood tugging and gnawing at the rotted altar cloth until the candlesticks fell and rolled on the slime-covered stones. And I remained standing, untouched, undead, reaching out suddenly for the plaster hand of the Virgin and seeing it break in my hand so that I held the hand crumbling in my palm, the pressure of my thumb turning it to powder. And then suddenly, through the ruins, up through the open door through which I could see a wasteland in all directions, even the great river frozen over and stuck with the encrusted ruins of ships, up through these ruins now came a funeral procession, a band of pale white men and women, monsters with gleaming eyes and flowing black clothes, the coffin rumbling on the wooden wheels, the rats scurrying across the broken and buckling marble, the procession advancing so that I could see then Claudia in the procession, her eyes staring from behind a thin black veil, one gloved hand locked upon a black prayer book, the other on the coffin as it moved beside her. And there, now, in the coffin, beneath a glass cover, I saw to my horror the skeleton of Lestat, the wrinkled skin now pressed into the very texture of his bones, his eyes but sockets, his blond hair billowed on the white satin. The procession stopped. The mourners moved out, filling the dusty pews without a sound, and Claudia, turning with her book, opened it and lifted the veil back from her face, her eyes fixed on me as her finger touched the page.
"And now art thou cursed from the earth," she whispered, a whisper rising in echo in the ruins. "And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth, and whoever slayeth thee, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." I shouted at her. I screamed, the scream rising up out of the depths of my being like some great rolling black force that broke from my lips and sent my body reeling against my will. A terrible sighing rose from the mourners, a chorus growing louder and louder, as I turned to see them all about me, pushing me into the aisle against the very sides of the coffin, so that I turned to get my balance and found both my hands upon it. And I stood there staring down, not at the remains of Lestat, but at the body of my mortal brother. A quiet descended, as if a veil had fallen over all, and made their forms dissolve beneath its soundless folds. There was my brother, blonde and young, and sweet as he had been in life, as real and warm to me now as he'd been years and years beyond which I could never have remembered him thus. So perfectly was he recreated, so perfectly in every detail. His blonde hair brushed back from his forehead, his eyes closed as if he slept, his smooth fingers around the crucifix on his breast, his lips so pink and silken I could hardly bear to see them and not touch them. And as I reached out just to touch the softness of his skin, the vision ended. I was sitting still in the Saturday night cathedral, the smell of the tapers thick in the motionless air, the woman of the stations gone and darkness gathering, behind me, across from me, and now above me. A boy appeared in the black cassock of a lay brother, with a long extinguisher on a golden pole, putting its little funnel down upon one candle, and then another, and then another. I was stupefied. He glanced at me and then away, as if not to disturb a man deep in prayer. And then, as he moved on up to the next chandelier, I felt a hand on my shoulder. That two humans should pass this close to me without my hearing, without my even caring, registered somewhere within me that I was in danger, but I did not care. I looked up now and saw a gray-haired priest. "You wish to go to confession?" he asked. "I was about to lock up the church." He narrowed his eyes behind his thick glasses. The only light now came from the racks of little red glass candles which burned before the saints, and shadows leapt upon the towering walls. "You are troubled, aren't you? Can I help you?" "It's too late, too late," I whispered to him and rose to go. He backed away from me, still apparently unaware of anything about my appearance that should alarm him, and said kindly to reassure me, "No, it's still early. Do you want to come into the confessional?" For a moment, I just stared at him. I was tempted to smile, and then it occurred to me to do it. But even as I followed him down the aisle, in the shadows of the vestibule, I knew this would be nothing, that it was madness. Nevertheless, I knelt down in the small wooden booth, my hands folded on the prie-dieu as he sat in the booth beside it, and slid back the panel to show me the dim outline of his profile. I stared at him for a moment, and then I said it, lifting my hand to make the sign of the cross. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Sinned so often and so long I do not know how to change, nor how to confess before God what I've done." "Son, God is infinite in his capacity to forgive," he whispered to me. "Tell him in the best way you know how and from your heart." "Murders, Father,
Death after death. The woman who died 2 nights ago in Jackson Square. I killed her. And thousands of others before her. One and two a night, Father, for 70 years. I have walked the streets of New Orleans like the Grim Reaper and fed on human life for my own existence. I am not mortal, Father, but immortal and damned, like angels put in hell by God. I am a vampire. The priest turned. What is this? Some sort of sport for you? Some joke? You take advantage of an old man? He said. He slid the wooden panel back with a splat. Quickly I opened the door and stepped out to see him standing there. Young man, do you fear God at all? Do you know the meaning of sacrilege? He glared at me. Now I moved closer to him. Slowly. Very slowly, and at first he merely stared at me, outraged. Then, confused, he took a step back. The church was hollow, empty, black. The sacristan gone, and the candles throwing ghastly light only on the distant altars. They made a wreath of soft gold fibers about his grey head and face. "Then there is no mercy," I said to him, and suddenly clamping my hands on his shoulders, I held him in a preternatural lock from which he couldn't hope to move, and held him close beneath my face. His mouth fell open in horror. "Do you see what I am? Why, if God exists, does he suffer me to exist?" I said to him. "You talk of sacrilege!" He dug his nails into my hands, trying to free himself. His missal dropping to the floor, his rosary clattering in the folds of his cassock. He might as well have fought the animated statues of the saints. I drew my lips back and showed him my virulent teeth. "Why does he suffer me to live?" I said. His face infuriated me, his fear, his contempt, his rage. I saw in it all the hatred I'd seen in Babette, and he hissed at me, "Let me go, devil!" in sheer mortal panic. I released him, watching with a sinister fascination as he floundered, moving up the center aisle as if he ploughed through snow. And then I was after him, so swift that I surrounded him in an instant with my outstretched arms, my cape throwing him into darkness, his legs scrambling still. He was cursing me, calling on God at the altar. And then I grabbed him on the very steps to the communion rail and pulled him down to face me there, and sank my teeth into his neck. The vampire stopped. Some time before, the boy had been about to light a cigarette. And he sat now with a match in one hand, the cigarette in the other, still as a store dummy, staring at the vampire. The vampire was looking at the floor. He turned suddenly, took the book of matches from the boy's hand, struck the match and held it out. The boy bent the cigarette to receive it. He inhaled and let the smoke out quickly. He uncapped the bottle and took a deep drink, his eyes always on the vampire. He was patient again, waiting until the vampire was ready to resume.
"I didn't remember Europe from my childhood.
Not even the voyage to America, really. That I had been born there was an abstract idea. Yet it had a hold over me which was as powerful as the hold France can have on a colonial. I spoke French, read French, remembered waiting for the reports of the Revolution, and reading the Paris newspaper accounts of Napoleon's victories. I remember the anger I felt when he sold the colony of Louisiana to the United States. How long the mortal Frenchman lived in me, I don't know. He was gone by this time, really. But there was in me that great desire to see Europe and to know it, which comes not only from the reading of all the literature and the philosophy, but from the feeling of having been shaped by Europe more deeply and keenly than the rest of Americans. I was a Creole who wanted to see where it had all begun. And so I turned my mind to this now, to divesting my closets and trunks of everything that was not essential to me, and very little was essential to me, really. And much of that might remain in the townhouse to which I was certain I would return sooner or later, if only to move my possessions to another similar one and start a new life in New Orleans. I couldn't conceive of leaving it forever. Wouldn't. But I fixed my mind and heart on Europe. It began to penetrate for the first time that I might see the world if I wanted, that I was, as Claudia said, free. Meantime, she made a plan. It was her idea most definitely that we must go first to Central Europe, where the vampire seemed most prevalent. She was certain we could find something there that would instruct us, explain our origins, but she seemed anxious for more than answers, a communion with her own kind. She mentioned this over and over, my own kind, and she said it with a different intonation than I might have used. She made me feel the gulf that separated us. In the first years of our life together, I had thought her like Lestat, imbibing his instinct to kill, though she shared my tastes in everything else. Now I knew her to be less human than either of us, less human than either of us might have dreamed. Not the faintest conception bound her to the sympathies of human existence. Perhaps this explained why. Despite everything I had done or failed to do, she clung to me. I was not her own kind, merely the closest thing to it. "But wouldn't it have been possible," asked the boy suddenly, "to instruct her in the ways of the human heart, the way you'd instructed her in everything else?"
"To what avail?" asked the vampire frankly. "So she might suffer as I did? Oh, I'll grant you I should have taught her something to prevail against her desire to kill Lestat. For my own sake I should have done that. But you see, I had no confidence in anything else. Once fallen from grace, I had confidence in nothing."
The boy nodded.
"I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were coming to something," he said.
"Only to the point that it was possible to forget what had happened to Lestat by turning my mind to Europe. And the thought of the other vampires inspired me also. I had not been cynical for one moment about the existence of God, only lost from it, drifting preternatural through the natural world. But we had another matter before we left for Europe. Oh, a great deal happened indeed. It began with a musician. He had called while I was gone that evening to the cathedral, and the next night he was to come again. I had dismissed the servants and went down to him myself, and his appearance startled me at once. He was much thinner than I'd remembered him, and very pale, with a moist gleam about his face that suggested fever, and he was perfectly miserable. When I told him Lestat had gone away, he refused at first to believe me and began insisting Lestat would have left him some message, something. And then he went off up the Rue Royale, talking to himself about it, as if he had little awareness of anyone around him. I caught up with him under a gas lamp. "He did leave you something," I said, quickly feeling for my wallet. I didn't know how much I had in it, but I planned to give it to him. It was several $100. I put it into his hands. They were so thin I could see the blue veins pulsing beneath the watery skin. Now he became exultant, and I sensed at once that the matter went beyond the money. "Then he spoke of me. He told you to give this to me," he said, holding on to it as though it were a relic. "He must have said something else to you." He stared at me with bulging, tortured eyes. I didn't answer him at once, because during these moments I had seen the puncture wounds in his neck. Two red, scratch-like marks to the right just above his soiled collar. The money flapped in his hand. He was oblivious to the evening traffic of the street, the people who pushed close around us. "Put it away," I whispered. "He did speak of you. that it was important you go on with your music. He stared at me as if anticipating something else.
Yes? Did he say anything else? He asked me.
I didn't know what to tell him. I would have made up anything if it would have given him comfort, and also kept him away. It was painful for me to speak of Lestat. The words evaporated on my lips, and the puncture wounds amazed me. I couldn't fathom this. I was saying nonsense to the boy, finally, that Lestat wished him well, that he had to take a steamboat up to St. Louis, that he would be back, that war was imminent, and he had business there. The boy hungering after every word, as if he couldn't possibly get enough, and was pushing on with it for the thing he wanted. He was trembling. The sweat broke out fresh on his forehead as he stood there pressing me, and suddenly he bit his lip hard and said, "But why did he go?" As if nothing had sufficed.
"What is it?" I asked him.
"What did you need from him? I'm sure he would want me to—"
"He was my friend," he turned on me suddenly, his voice dropping with repressed outrage.
"You're not well," I said to him. "You need rest. There's something," and now I pointed to it, attentive to his every move, "on your throat." He didn't even know what I meant. His fingers searched for the place, found it, rubbed it.
"What does it matter? I don't know. The insects, they're everywhere," he said, turning away from me. "Did he say anything else?"
For a long while I watched him move up the Rue Royale, a frantic, lanky figure in rusty black, for whom the bulk of the traffic made way. I told Claudia at once about the wound on his throat. It was our last night in New Orleans. We'd board the ship just before midnight tomorrow for an early morning departure. We had agreed to walk out together. She was being solicitous, and there was something remarkably sad in her face, something which had not left after she had cried.
"What could the marks mean?" she asked me now. "That he fed on the boy when the boy slept? That the boy allowed it? I can't imagine," she said.
"Yes, that must be what it is." But I was uncertain. I remembered now Lestat's remark to Claudia, that he knew a boy who would make a better vampire than she. Had he planned to do that? Planned to make another one of us?
"It doesn't matter now, Louis," she reminded me.
We had to say our farewell to New Orleans. We were walking away from the crowds of the Rue Royale. My senses were keen to all around me, holding it close, reluctant to say this was the last night. The old French city had been for the most part burned a long time ago, and the architecture of these days was as it is now, Spanish, which meant that as we walked slowly through the very narrow street where one cabriolet had to stop for another, we passed whitewashed walls and great courtyard gates that revealed distant, lamp-lit courtyard paradises like our own. Only each seemed to hold such promise, such sensual mystery. Great banana trees stroked the galleries of the inner courts, and masses of fern and flower crowded the mouth of the passage. Above, in the dark, figures sat on the balconies, their backs to the open doors, their hushed voices and the flapping of their fans barely audible above the soft river breeze. And over the walls grew wisteria and passiflora so thick that we could brush against it as we passed, and stopped occasionally at this place or that to pluck a luminescent rose or tendrils of honeysuckle. Through the high windows we saw again and again the play of candlelight on richly embossed plaster ceilings, and often the bright iridescent wreath of a crystal chandelier. Occasionally, a figure dressed for evening appeared at the railings, the glitter of jewels at her throat, her perfume adding a lush, evanescent spice to the flowers in the air. We had our favorite streets, gardens, corners, but inevitably we reached the outskirts of the old city and saw the rise of swamp. Carriage after carriage passed us, coming in from the Bayou Road, bound for the theater or the opera. But now the lights of the city lay behind us, and its mingled scents were drowned in the thick odor of swamp decay. The very sight of the tall, wavering trees, their limbs hung with moss, had sickened me, made me think of Lestat. I was thinking of him as I thought of my brother's body. I was seeing him sunk deep among the roots of cypress and oak, that hideous, withered form folded in the white sheet. I wondered if the creatures of the dark shunned him, knowing instinctively the parched, crackling thing there was virulent, or whether they swarmed about him in the reeking water, picking his ancient dried flesh from the bones. I turned away from the swamps, back to the heart of the old city, and felt the gentle press of Claudia's hand comforting. She had gathered a natural bouquet from all the garden walls, and she held it crushed to the bosom of her yellow dress, her face buried in its perfume. Now she said to me, in such a whisper that I bent my ear to her, "Louis, it troubles you. You know the remedy. Let the flesh instruct the mind." She let my hand go, and I watched her move away from me, turning once to whisper the same command, "Forget him, let the flesh instruct the mind." It brought back to me that book of poems I'd held in my hand when she first spoke these words to me, and I saw the verse upon the page. Her lips were red, her looks were free, her locks were yellow as gold, her skin was as white as leprosy. The nightmare life in death was she, who thicks man's blood with cold. She was smiling from the far corner, a bit of yellow silk visible for a moment in the narrowing dark, then gone. My companion forever. I was turning into the Rue du Maine, moving past darkened windows. A lamp died very slowly behind a broad scrim of heavy lace, the shadow of the pattern on the brick expanding, growing fainter, then vanishing into blackness. I moved on, nearing the house of Madame Leclerc, hearing faint but shrill the violins from the upstairs parlour, and then the thin metallic laughter of the guests. I stood across from the house in the shadows, seeing a small handful of them moving in the lighted room. From window to window moved one guest, a pale, lemon-coloured wine in his stem glass. His face turned towards the moon as if he sought something from a better vantage, and found it, finally, at the last window, his hand on the dark drape. Across from me a door stood open in the brick wall, and a light fell on the passage at the far end. I moved silently over the narrow street and met the thick aromas of the kitchen rising on the air past the gate, the slightly nauseating smell of cooking meat. I stepped into the passage. Someone had just walked fast across the courtyard and shut a rear door. But then I saw another figure. She stood by the kitchen fire, a lean black woman with a brilliant tignon around her head, her features delicately chiselled and gleaming in the light like a figure in diorite. She stirred the mixture in the kettle. I caught the sweet smell of the spices and the fresh green of marjoram and bay. And then in a wave came the horrid smell of the cooking meat, the blood and flesh decaying in the boiling fluids. I drew near, saw her set down her long iron spoon and stand with her hands on her generous tapered hips, the white of her apron sash outlining her small, fine waist. The juices of the pot foamed on the lip and spit in the glowing coals below. Her dark odour came to me, her dusky, spiced perfume, stronger than the curious mixture from the pot, tantalizing as I drew nearer and rested back against a wall of matted vine. Upstairs, the thin violins began a waltz, and the floorboards groaned with the dancing couples. The jasmine of the wall enclosed me and then receded like water leaving the clean-swept beach, and again I sensed her salt perfume. She had moved to the kitchen door, her long black neck gracefully bent as she peered into the shadows beneath the lighted window. "Monsieur," she said, and stepped out now into the shaft of yellow light. It fell on her great round breasts and long, sleek, silken arms, and now on the long, cold beauty of her face. "You're looking for the party, monsieur?" she asked. "The party's upstairs." "No, my dear. I wasn't looking for the party," I said to her, moving forward out of the shadows. "I was looking for you." Everything was ready when I woke the next evening. The wardrobe trunk on its way to the ship, as well as a chest which contained a coffin. The servants gone. The furnishings draped in white. The sight of the tickets and a collection of notes of credit and some other papers all placed together in a flat black wallet made the trip emerge into the bright light of reality. I would have foregone killing had that been possible, and so I took care of this early and perfunctorily, as did Claudia, and as it neared time for us to leave, I was alone in the flat, waiting for her. She had been gone too long for my nervous frame of mind. I feared for her, though she could bewitch almost anyone into assisting her if she found herself too far away from home, and had many times persuaded strangers to bring her to her very door. To her father, who thanked them profusely for returning his lost daughter. When she came now, she was running, and I fancied as I put my book down that she had forgotten the time. She thought it later than it was. By my pocket watch we had an hour. But the instant she reached the door, I knew that this was wrong. "Louis, the doors!" she gasped, her chest heaving, her hand at her heart. She ran back down the passage with me behind her, and as she desperately signalled me, I shut up the doors to the gallery. "What is it?" I asked her. "What's come over you?" But she was moving to the front windows now, the long French windows which opened onto the narrow balconies over the street. She lifted the shade of the lamp and quickly blew out the flame. The room went dark, and then lightened gradually with the illumination of the street. She stood panting, her hand on her breast, and then she reached out for me and drew me close to her beside the window. "Someone followed me," she whispered now. "I could hear him block after block behind me. At first I thought it was nothing." She stopped for breath, her face blanched in the bluish light that came from the windows across the way. "Louis, it was the musician," she whispered. "But what does that matter? He must have seen you with Lestat."
"Louis, he's down there. Look out the window. Try to see him."
She seemed so shaken, almost afraid, as if she would not stand exposed on the threshold. I stepped out on the balcony, though I held her hand as she hovered by the drape, and she held me so tightly that it seemed she feared for me. It was 11 o'clock, and the Rue Royale for the moment was quiet. Shops shut. The traffic of the theatre just gone away. A door slammed somewhere to my right, and I saw a woman and a man emerge and hurry towards the corner, the woman's face hidden beneath an enormous white hat. Their steps died away. I could see no one, sense no one. I could hear Claudia's labored breathing. Something stirred in the house. I started, then recognized it as the jingling and rustling of the birds. We'd forgotten the birds. But Claudia had started worse than I, and she pulled near to me. "There is no one, Claudia," I started to whisper to her. Then I saw the musician. He had been standing so still in the doorway of the furniture shop that I had been totally unaware of him, and he must have wanted this to be so. For now he turned his face upwards towards me, and it shone from the dark like a white light. The frustration and care were utterly erased from his stark features. His great dark eyes peered at me from the white flesh. He had become a vampire. "I see him," I murmured to her, my lips as still as possible, my eyes holding his eyes. I felt her move closer, her hand trembling, a heart beating in the palm of her hand. She let out a gasp when she saw him now. But at that same moment something chilled me even as I stared at him and he did not move. Because I heard a step in the lower passage, I heard the gate hinge groan,
and then that step again, deliberate, loud, echoing under the arched ceiling of the carriageway, deliberate, familiar. That step advancing now up the spiral stairs. A thin scream rose from Claudia, and then she caught it at once with her hand. The vampire in the furniture shop door had not moved, and I knew the step on the stairs. I knew the step on the porch. It was Lestat. Lestat pulling on the door, now pounding on it, now ripping at it as if to tear it loose from the very wall. Claudia moved back into the corner of the room, her body bent as if someone had struck her a sharp blow, her eyes moving frantically from the figure in the street to me. The pounding on the door grew louder, and then I heard his voice. "Louis!" he called to me. "Louis!" he roared against the door. And then came the smash of the back parlor window, and I could hear the latch turning from within. Quickly I grabbed the lamp, struck a match hard and broke it in my frenzy, then got the flame as I wanted it and held the small vessel of kerosene poised in my hand. "Get away from the window! Shut it!" I told her, and she obeyed as if a sudden, clear-spoken command released her from a paroxysm of fear. "And light the other lamps, now, at once!" I heard her crying as she struck the match. Lestat was coming down the hallway, and then he stood at the door. I let out a gasp, and, not meaning to, I must have taken several steps backwards when I saw him. I could hear Claudia's cry. It was Lestat, beyond question, restored and intact as he hung in the doorway, his head thrust forward, his eyes bulging as if he were drunk and needed the door jamb to keep him from plunging headlong into the room. His skin was a mass of scars, a hideous covering of injured flesh, as though every wrinkle of his death had left its mark upon him. He was seared and marked as if by the random strokes of a hot poker, and his once clear grey eyes were shot with hemorrhaged vessels. "Stay back, for the love of God," I whispered. "I'll throw it at you. I'll burn you alive," I said to him. And at the same moment I could hear a sound to my left, something scraping, scratching against the façade of the townhouse. It was the other one. I saw his hands now on the wrought-iron balcony. Claudia let out a piercing scream as he threw his weight against the glass doors. I cannot tell you all that happened then. I cannot possibly recount it as it was. I remember heaving the lamp at Lestat. It smashed at his feet, and the flames rose at once from the carpet. I had a torch then in my hands, a great tangle of sheet I'd pulled from the couch and ignited in the flames, but I was struggling with him before that, kicking and driving savagely at his great strength, and somewhere in the background were Claudia's panicked screams, and the other lamp was broken, and the drapes of the windows blazed. I remember that his clothes reeked of kerosene and that he was at one point smacking wildly at the flames. He was clumsy, sick, unable to keep his balance. But when he had me in his grip, I even tore at his fingers with my teeth to get him off. There was noise rising in the street, shouts, the sound of a bell. The room itself had fast become an inferno, and I did see in one clear blast of light Claudia battling the fledgling vampire. He seemed unable to close his hands on her, like a clumsy human after a bird. I remember rolling over and over with Lestat in the flames, feeling the suffocating heat in my face, seeing the flames above his back when I rolled under him. And then Claudia rose up out of the confusion and was striking at him over and over with the poker until his grip broke and I scrambled loose from him. I saw the poker coming down again and again on him and could hear the snarls rising from Claudia in time with the poker, like the stress of an unconscious animal. Lestat was holding his hand, his face a grimace of pain, and there, sprawled on the smouldering carpet, lay the other one, blood flowing from his head. What happened then is not clear to me. I think I grabbed the poker from her and gave him one fine blow with it to the side of the head. I remember that he seemed unstoppable, invulnerable to the blows. The heat by this time was singeing my clothes, had caught Claudia's gossamer gown, so that I grabbed her up and ran down the passage trying to stifle the flames with my body. I remember taking off my coat
and beating at the flames in the open air, and men rushing up the stairs and past me.
A great crowd swelled from the passage into the courtyard, and someone stood on the sloped roof of the brick kitchen.
I had Claudia in my arms now and was rushing past them all, oblivious to the questions, thrusting a shoulder through them, making them divide. And then I was free with her, hearing her pant and sob in my ear, running blindly down the Rue Royale, down the first narrow street, running and running until there was no sound but the sound of my running, and her breath. And we stood there, the man and the child, scorched and aching, and breathing deep in the quiet of night.
Part 2. All night long I stood on the deck of the French ship Mariana, watching the gangplanks. The long levee was crowded, and parties lasted late in the lavish staterooms, the decks rumbling with passengers and guests. But finally, as the hours moved toward dawn, the parties were over one by one, and carriages left the narrow riverfront streets. A few late passengers came aboard. A couple lingered for hours at the rail nearby, but Lestat and his apprentice, if they survived the fire, and I was convinced that they had, did not find their way to the ship. Our luggage had left the flat that day, and if anything had remained to let them know our destination, I was sure it had been destroyed. Yet still I watched. Claudia sat securely locked in our stateroom, her eyes fixed on the porthole. But Lestat did not come. Finally, as I'd hoped, the commotion of putting out commenced before daylight. A few people waved from the pier and the grassy hump of the levee as the great ship began first to shiver, then to jerk violently to one side, and then to slide out in one great, majestic motion into the current of the Mississippi. The lights of New Orleans grew small and dim, until there appeared behind us only a pale phosphorescence against the lightening clouds. I was fatigued beyond my worst memory, yet I stood on the deck for as long as I could see that light, knowing that I might never see it again. In moments we were carried downstream past the piers of Frenière and Pointe du Lac, and then, as I could see the great wall of cottonwood and cypress growing green out of the darkness along the shore, I knew it was almost morning. Too perilously close. And as I put the key into the lock of the cabin, I felt the greatest exhaustion, perhaps, that I'd ever known. Never, in all the years I'd lived in our select family, had I known the fear I'd experienced tonight, the vulnerability, the sheer terror. And there was to be no sudden relief from it, no sudden sense of safety. Only that relief which weariness at last imposes, when neither mind nor body can endure the terror any longer. For though Lestat was now miles away from us, he had in his resurrection awakened in me a tangle of complex fears which I could not escape. Even as Claudia said to me, "We're safe, Louis, safe." And I whispered the word "yes" to her, I could see Lestat hanging in the doorway, see those bulbous eyes, that scarred flesh. How had he come back? How had he triumphed over death? How could any creature have survived that shriveled ruin he'd become? Whatever the answer, what did it mean, not only for him but for Claudia, for me? Safe from him we were. But safe from ourselves? The ship was struck by a strange fever. It was amazingly clean of vermin, however, though occasionally their bodies might be found weightless and dry, as if the creatures had been dead for days. Yet there was this fever. It struck a passenger first in the form of weakness and a soreness about the throat. Occasionally there were marks there, and occasionally the marks were someplace else, or sometimes there were no recognizable marks at all, though an old wound was reopened and painful again.
And sometimes the passenger who fell to sleeping more and more as the voyage progressed and the fever progressed died in his sleep. So there were burials at sea on several occasions as we crossed the Atlantic. Naturally afraid of fever, I shunned the passengers, did not wish to join them in the smoking room to get to know their stories, hear their dreams and expectations. I took my meals alone. But Claudia liked to watch the passengers, to stand on deck and see them come and go in the early evening, to say softly to me later as I sat at the porthole, "I think she'll fall prey." I would put the book down and look out the porthole, feeling the gentle rocking of the sea, seeing the stars, more clear and brilliant than they had ever been on land, dipping down to touch the waves. It seemed at moments, when I sat alone in the dark stateroom, that the sky had come down to meet the sea, and that some great secret was to be revealed in that meeting, some great gulf miraculously closed forever. But who was to make this revelation when the sky and sea became indistinguishable and neither any longer was chaos? God or Satan? It struck me suddenly what consolation it would be to know Satan, to look upon his face, no matter how terrible that countenance was, to know that I belonged to him totally, and thus put to rest forever the torment of this ignorance. To step through some veil that would forever separate me from all that I called human nature. I felt the ship moving closer and closer to this secret. There was no visible end to the firmament. It closed about us with breathtaking beauty and silence. But then the words, "put to rest," became horrible. Because there would be no rest in damnation, could be no rest, and what was this torment compared to the restless fires of hell? The sea rocking beneath those constant stars, those stars themselves, what had this to do with Satan? And those images which sound so static to us in childhood when we are all so taken up with mortal frenzy that we can scarce imagine them desirable, seraphim gazing forever upon the face of God, and the face of God itself. This was rest eternal, of which this gentle, cradling sea was only the faintest promise. But even in these moments, when the ship slept, and all the world slept, neither heaven nor hell seemed more than a tormenting fancy. To know, to believe in one or the other, that was perhaps the only salvation for which I could dream. Claudia, with Lestat's liking for light, lit the lamps when she rose. She had a marvelous pack of playing cards, acquired from a lady on board. The picture cards were in the fashion of Marie Antoinette, and the backs of the cards bore gold fleur-de-lis on gleaming violet. She played a game of solitaire in which the cards made the numbers of a clock. And she asked me, until I finally began to answer her, how Lestat had accomplished it. She was no longer shaken. If she remembered her screams in the fire, she did not care to dwell on them. If she remembered that, before the fire, she had wept real tears in my arms, it made no change in her. She was, as always in the past, a person of little indecision, a person for whom habitual quiet did not mean anxiety or regret. "We should have burned him," she said. "We were fools to think from his appearance that he was dead." "But how could he have survived?" I asked her. "You saw him? You know what became of him?" I had no taste for it, really. I would have gladly pushed it to the back of my mind, but my mind would not allow me to. And it was she who gave me the answers now, for the dialogue was really with herself. "Suppose, though, he had ceased to fight us," she explained. "That he was still living, locked in that helpless, dried corpse, conscious and calculating." "Conscious in that state?" I whispered. "And suppose, when he reached the swamp waters and heard the sounds of our carriage going away, that he had strength enough to propel those limbs to move. There were creatures all around him in the dark. I saw him once rip the head of a small garden lizard and watch the blood run down into a glass.
Can you imagine the tenacity of the will to live in him, his hands groping in that water for anything that moved?
The will to live? Tenacity? I murmured. Suppose it was something else.
And then, when he'd felt the resuscitation of his strength,